song the same and sing it till you're done. Yes, yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber bands straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. And they brought death to hometown, boys. Death to hometown, boys. Death to hometown.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions, where we talk about solutions to problems, not just gripe about the conditions. Okay, today's show, I'm going to go solo, and we're going to follow up on some recent show themes. One will be Obamacare. We had a show a couple weeks ago on is Obamacare unwinding? And I want to follow up on that because there is some news, further news to that subject that deserves some discussion. Second, last week we talked about, I had some guests, we talked about the AFL-CIO's upcoming convention in early September and what might be an important shift in indications emerging that the AFL-CIO might have new members, bring in community organizations, community groups like Sierra Club, NAACP, La Raza, and so forth as voting members. We're going to talk about some early comments and views that have emerged here in the last week with regard to that topic, the AFL-CIO convention. Okay. And by the way, we will have some delegates from that convention in a future show on this Alternative Vision show, okay? And thirdly, I want to talk about some latest updates on the economy. We've got some new news here on the Eurozone, on Japan, China, and the U.S., so I want to follow up a little bit and discuss some of those, the latest in the last few weeks, month reports. As you know, earlier in early June, I released my predictions for 2013-14, economic predictions in the U.S. global economy, had a show on that, my article on that predicting the global economy 2013-14 appeared in Z Magazine on July 1st, excuse me, and you can read that also on my website. Just go to kikrosproductions.com, www, and that's spelled K-Y-K-L-O-S, productions.com. Or you can go to the Z Magazine website and read it there. Anyway, those were my annual predictions, and I've recently written a piece, a follow-up piece to that on the latest information, which appeared yesterday in Counterpunch. The Counterpunch blog, just counterpunch.org, and also on the ZNet blog, ZNet.org. You can read my latest view on that called The Stop-Go U.S. Economic Recovery. Okay, so I want to talk about that a little bit at the very end, if we have time, but three topics today. One, Obamacare. Is it sliding? Obamacare sliding disassembly? And the AFL-CIO convention. And as part of the convention topic, I want to give my own views on that subject. Last week we had three guests. If you're interested in that discussion, go back to the archives and listen to it. We had Steve Early from California, Richmond, a longtime union officer and activist, now very active in labor community events out in Richmond. Labor Community Coalition activities, and we had Zach Robinson in North Carolina, active in the Moral Mondays protests out there with the churches and other community groups. As you know, North Carolina is really rolling back even the most basic voting rights laws and so forth. New Republican governor there, and We also had Jim Moran from Philadelphia. We all talked about this latest AFL-CIO possibility and the public reference to giving community groups voting rights in the AFL-CIO Federation at the top as representatives in the Federation, okay? And we'll have further discussion on that upcoming. But I want to say a few things about my views on the need to reinvent American labor, American unions. And that reinvention would require a very important structural, organizational changes. And I want to talk about those. I wrote about those 8 years ago and said that would have to occur if labor was to in any way stem its increasingly accelerating decline, which, of course, has occurred since 2005, hasn't it, in the last 8 years. Labor's even worse shape than it was then. Okay, so I want to talk about that, some of my views on that, lay them out for you and for your consideration, and I'll be writing on that as well very shortly this week, Reinventing American Unions. And you can take a look at that either on my website, on my blog, jackrasmus.com, on several public blogs. I'm sure it will be reproduced. Check out talkingunion.org, where I usually write about union developments. And, of course, check out the Stop-Go Economic Recovery in the U.S. That's already up on the blogs and up on my website. Okay, and then the third thing we'll talk about, if we have time, some of the updates on recent trends in the U.S. economy. A digression, preview of shows coming up in the next few weeks here on Alternative Visions. One, we're going to have participants who were at the recent National Democracy Convention. You might say Save Democracy Convention in the U.S., in Wisconsin, which occurred last week. We're going to have a couple folks back who were at the convention, and let's see what the discussion is. How to defend democracy in the U.S., which is under even the most fundamental elements of the democratic rights, like voting rights, which, you know, voting does not equal democracy, but it certainly is an essential element of it. But that's under big attack all across the country. Voting rights. Okay, so we'll have some folks come back on and talk about the Democracy Convention. We're also going to have some guests from North Carolina and the Moral Mondays protests, public protests, and arrests and so forth. Folks are beginning to fight down there. It's not getting much coverage, obviously. The corporate press does not want people to know what's going on down there. They just might replicate it where they live. So it's kind of a blackout. But we'll have folks, we had Zach Robinson talk about that a little bit, but I think it deserves a show of its own. So we'll have Moral Mondays coming up. And then I also want to talk about, in coming weeks, the corporate tax code. And the big cuts in corporate taxes that are now coming, and this big tax code revision, which is on fast track going through the House. This is going to get integrated, tied in with the deficit debt ceiling confrontation that's coming in September, October as well. And as I predicted in my long article, Austerity American Style, that this tax code revision will be the glue that will eventually bring together a new deal on debt ceiling and deficit cutting and so forth. In other words, give corporations a big tax cut. You know, if you look historically at the U.S. in the last 30 years, whenever there's been a big tax move for individual income taxes, you know, particularly for rich investors, you know, dividends and capital gains and inheritance taxes and all that, whenever that's occurred and gotten out of the way, then what follows is a big subsequent corporate tax cut move. Look, that's what happened in the 1980s. And that's what happened under George W. Bush. Cut taxes big time for wealthy folks. The Bush tax cuts, we've talked about them before, amounted to $3.4 trillion in tax cuts for 80% went to the wealthiest households in 2001, 2, and 3. But folks aren't so aware of the corporate tax cuts that followed in 2004 and 5 because it wasn't one big package. It was industry by industry, or sector by sector, but just as significant, the corporate tax cuts. And okay, so how does that compare to today? Well, Obama extended the Bush tax cuts for the rich for 2 years, gave him another $450 billion, and then we got this phony fiscal cliff deal where they took back just $60 billion a year. Okay, so $400 billion continued tax cuts every year for the next decade for the rich, and they took back $60 billion a year. Okay. That's the individual tax cut thing that occurred once again. But now we got the big corporate tax cut follow-on moves in the works, and that will include reducing the top corporate tax rate from 35 to 28% at least, big cuts for multinational corporations who are hoarding $2 trillion in offshore subsidiaries, refusing to pay tax on it, and et cetera, et cetera. That's coming. All right, that'll be tied up with the confrontations over deficit cutting, debt ceiling, and so forth. If you want to read that, my whole analysis of the last 4 years on taxes and deficit cutting, just read Austerity American Style, which also appears, by the way, in the magazine Against the Current. All right, then I want to talk about some monetary issues. You know, the Federal Reserve is trying desperately to, quote, taper, unquote, they call it taper. It's $85 billion a year, free money going to investors, buying up bonds and so forth, keeping interest rates near zero for bankers. And that is possibly going to start being reduced. As I said in previous shows, the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, attempted to do that in June, provoked a big reaction by investors in the financial markets. Asset prices began to collapse, stocks and bonds and so forth across the board. Quickly, Bernanke and the Fed quickly backed off of that, and all the stock market went back up and so forth. Okay, I want to talk about QE. After all, I am the shadow chair for the Federal Reserve for as part of the Green Shadow Cabinet. We've talked about that. I also want to talk about bitcoins. Have you heard about bitcoins? Okay, what are bitcoins? Oh, that's digital money. I call it digital tulips. Well, I remember tulips, the tulip craze, the first financial speculative bubble way back in the 17th century in the Netherlands. Investors were buying tulips. Big demand for tulips. The price of tulips went up and up, and everyone kept paying more because they kept flipping the tulips, buying them and selling them. And that caused a big financial bubble and a big crash. Well, bitcoins are something similar. All right. Now, I also want to talk about bail-ins. We've talked about that a little bit with regard to Cyprus and the Eurozone banks, but as my guest in the past on the show, Ellen Brown, has talked about the bail-in, how they're going to make depositors pay for the next banking crisis, which is coming. So, bitcoins, bail-ins, and public banking will be a topic. And then after the FSL convention in the first week of September, we'll have delegates back on the show, and we'll talk about what the AFL-CIO is actually doing. But what did it decide with regard to community organizations? Okay, so once again, to recap, future shows, coming future weeks, Democracy Convention Report, North Carolina Moral Mondays Report, the Corporate Tax Code and congressional developments on that front, monetary policy, Fed, QE, bitcoins, bail-ins, and then the AFL-CIO convention again. Okay. enough for introduction. Let's move on to something of substance here. Alright. As I said at the beginning of the show, three topics. One, let's revisit Obamacare's crisis, and then the AFL-CIO convention and my views. Alright. Obamacare. The rolling crisis in Obamacare. Now, to recap my views on Obamacare, just make it clear, you know, I'm not coming from the right wing in terms of my criticism of Obamacare. There are some good provisions in Obamacare. But Obamacare, I've always said, will not solve the problem. It will implode. And we'll be back to the only real solution to the growing health care crisis and cost crisis in this country, which is Medicare for all. Maybe combined with some sort of transitional public option. Now, remember, when the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was passed, Obama ruled out talking about Medicare for all. And the public option, where there would be a public insurance choice, was on the table briefly, and then he pulled it off the table. So all we got was health insurance reform, Health Insurance Company Reform Act, not a health care act. They say it's not a health care act. It's a Insurance Company Reform Act. And the reform is bought at the price big handouts to the insurance companies. Okay. Now, I said there were some good provisions here. You know, pre-existing conditions. Insurance companies can't deny pre-existing conditions. They got to cover dependents up to age 26. Limits on out-of-pocket expenses. All right, these were all positive things, but it cost us $1 trillion. To pay for these few positive pluses. It seems to me I always did that, you know, we could have gotten something better for less cost for the money here. So there are some good provisions in it, and there are some taxes on the wealthy here, and that's why corporations and Tea Partiers are, you know, just apoplectic about this act. They don't want to pay even the token stuff. All right. But there are some real negative provisions. First of all, I don't believe it will control runaway health care costs. And that's the number one problem here. You know, we spend in this country nearly $3 trillion a year, 18% of GDP, on health care costs. 18%. Okay, what do the Europeans with Medicare for all type, or just about everybody else in the world, advanced world. Come on, you know, it's North America, Japan, everybody has a form of Medicare for all. Well, they pay about 10% of their GDP for health care costs. You know, the quality of health care in France and Germany is probably better than in the U.S. And they pay 10%. We pay almost twice as much. Well, why do we pay so much more? Well, the other 8% is to the middleman, to the insurance companies, health insurance companies, who don't deliver one iota of medical services. They pass paper around, and they skim off the top, and the money they skim off the top, they use to invest globally in derivatives and so on and so forth. That's their real business, insurance companies. You know, insurance is secondary, you know, reinvesting that money, those premiums, in other financial assets is really what that's all about. They're really banks, shadow banks, we call them. Okay. Runaway costs is the big problem. And if we simply got rid of the middleman, saved ourselves 8% of GDP, which is $1 trillion or more a year, going to a Medicare for All solution, well, then we could take that $1 trillion a year and apply it towards expanding Medicare. It would go a long way. You might be able to institute a kind of a system where people could choose whether they wanted to go Medicare for all. In other words, if you were not yet 65, you could choose Medicare. Or if you were worried about Medicare, you know, you wanted your own private deal, then go to a public option insurance. So Medicare plus public option is the way to go. Some combination of that. And neither of those, of course, Obama and the Republicans want to talk about. Wouldn't even allow it in the debates. Okay, another thing that's a problem with the ACA, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, is the penalties are insufficient to ensure adequate enrollment to bring the cost down. You know, you've got to have general participation in the ACA in order for these health care exchanges to lower the health insurance premiums. The problem, as I've talked about in the past, is that the penalties are insufficient. It's going to be more cost-effective for both individuals and companies to pay the penalties than it is to pay the monthly premium costs. You got to really raise the penalties. And the subsidies that the government's going to provide to low-income folks in order to buy the insurance are insufficient. They're too low. That's the big contradiction here. Right? Penalties are too low and subsidies are too low. Therefore, enrollment will be too low. Therefore, premiums will rise, i.e., no control of health care costs in the long run. Now, Republicans, of course, are the big problem here, both in the House and in the governorships. They're boycotting this thing. Okay? And if you boycott, you don't enroll. If these Republican states refuse to enroll in the health insurance exchanges, well, that's going to limit participation. Limiting participation raises the costs. Okay? They're refusing to set up insurance exchanges. A couple dozen states controlled by Republican governors that are doing this. Okay, well, then under the law, the federal government can set up the exchanges. Well, they're far from even beginning to do that in those states. And as we're laying off federal employees, where are we going to get the skilled people to set up these exchanges, federal government to set up exchanges, where the states refuse to do so? Right? And, of course, these same states are boycotting the Medicaid provisions of the ACA. Another big problem with the ACA, Obamacare, is it's accelerating the death of union-negotiated health care plans. You know, by 2018, if you have, they call it a Cadillac plan, okay, if you have one of these traditional healthcare, employer healthcare plans, you know, the ones that we used to have in the 80s and 90s and everyone accepted as normal, and now they're called Cadillac. In other words, really good plans. Well, they're only really good because everything else has collapsed. But they do cost a hell of a lot. And what Obamacare has proposed, the act has proposed, is to implement a 40% increase, a 40% excise tax, an increase on premiums for these plans. Well, that's going to kill these plans overnight. And the unions are just beginning to wake up to the fact that, uh-oh, you know, maybe we shouldn't have agreed to this just because it's the Democratic Party. They thought, well, if we put it off for 8 years to 2018, from 2010 when the act was passed, we can transition some way. Well, they're finding out they're halfway to 2018 and the transition doesn't look so good. Why? Because employers, knowing this is coming, are refusing to agree to any negotiated increases in payment for health care insurance. They're putting a cap. They're capping what they're paying right now, and it's causing all kinds of problems within the unions, meaning that you either strike over it or your folks are going to have to pay more. Your members are going to have to pay more over the next 4 years. And if you're paying a lot more just to maintain your health care, then you can't get wage increases. All right? That's called maintenance of benefits, MOB, negotiating. Let's move our money to maintain our health care and our pensions instead of wage increases. And one of the reasons why wages are declining. Unions for 20 years now, since Clinton, have been putting more and more money into maintaining their health care so they can't negotiate wage increases. It's all going to insurance companies. Okay, so now the unions are saying, oh, wow, 40% tax, that means the end of all this. Our general standard historical decent health care insurance negotiated plans. And we're seeing some unions breaking rank now over this topic, particularly laborers and firefighters and so forth. They're saying, well, wait a minute, you know, why are you attacking us, making us, the unions, and our members pay? Right. Well, for Obamacare to work, in other words, everyone's got to participate in health insurance exchanges. And that means all you union-negotiated plans and members have to get off of those plans and jump into the insurance exchanges. What are the insurance exchanges except privatized health care? Yes, privatization. This is privatization of health care. This is an extension. Obamacare is an extension of George W. Bush's health savings accounts. In other words, no more collective negotiating. Go out and get your own. We'll give you some money. You know, government will subsidize you a little bit. The employers will continue what they're paying. They won't pay any more, and as costs keep going up, you, the individual, has to put more out of pocket. Increasing. They're just shifting the cost. They did this with pensions, didn't they? They got rid of real pensions, defined benefit pensions, and said, go pay for your 401k or ERA. In other words, employers are throwing overboard any of their own responsibility and liability for participating and helping pay for health care and or retirement. This agreement where the companies would negotiate with unions and in general provide, even with no unions, health care and pensions, originated right after World War II in the late 40s, early 50s. Right? This was part of the social contract. This is part of the agreement, by the way, for the unions to stop pushing for Social Security, for national health care coverage under Social Security, and for a better retirement under Social Security. Go negotiate it yourself, businesses, unions, and they did that. They broke with the long-standing union position in the 30s and 40s that we were going to push politically for Medicare for all and pensions for all. Instead of politically, oh, go and do it individually, union by union. And when the unions were stronger, they could do that for their membership. But now the unions have been destroyed, almost. And the social contract is busted. And we see the disappearance of retirement benefits and health care benefits. So this whole social contract thing in the post-World War II period has collapsed. And with it, the unions are collapsing. And with it, bargaining, creating defined benefit pensions, where you're guaranteed so much per year of service, and union-negotiated health care are disappearing as well. Right. So think of Obamacare as a direct descendant of George Bush's health savings accounts, as a direct descendant of Bill Clinton's health maintenance organizations, and a parallel to the destruction of defined benefit plans and the replacement of 401ks. This is all about privatizing social wages. You see, social wages are not just the pay in dollars that you get. Social wages are your benefits. So much is put into the social wage that you collect at a later time, not right away in your paycheck, but you collect it when you retire if it's a pension, or you collect it when you need it, when you have a health need. Well, they've rolled back real wages, nominal wages, destroying unions and other ways, creating part-time temp work, lowered the real wage, but they're also attacking now the social wage that's embedded in the benefits. Rolling back wages as benefits as well as wages as direct pay. Okay, so what are some of the recent indications that Obamacare, the ACA is about to unwind. We talked about that a few weeks ago. There have been a few developments since then that we're going to talk about as well. But first, we're going to take our break here. So come back, and we'll continue talking about the problems with Obamacare. And then we're going to move on to my views on the AFL-CIO in union labor and what needs to happen for them to reinvent themselves and prevent a total disappearance in 2020. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back to these two themes.
Sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. And we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming. I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be alright.
This is Jack Rasmus, your host, Alternative Visions, and we've been talking about updates to the Obamacare ACA, and we will shortly also get into the AFL-CIO convention issue again, but let me conclude here on the discussion on the Obamacare. Our show a couple of weeks ago was in response to an announcement by the Obama administration that they were suspending the employer mandate to participate. In other words, under the 2010 law, employers by January 1st, 2014, were supposed to participate in the new act. In other words, provide health insurance for their employees if they didn't, according to the new minimum requirements. Okay. Well, in July, we reported and discussed how this mandate, employer mandate as they call it, due January 1st, 2014, was put off to 2015. Right? We're talking about, hundreds of thousands of companies here. They're given a reprieve for another year. Oh, it just so happens that this reprieve is after the 2014 midterm elections. Okay, that's significant here. So there's politics going on here, no doubt. It's not just the employers can't get ready in time. That's nonsense. Like they've had 3 years, 4 years it would have been to get ready. So that was an important backtracking unilaterally by Obama himself, saying, okay, you don't have to participate, employer mandate. Now, it's interesting to note that the employee mandate, if you aren't in a company, a large enough company, small companies don't have to, but if you participate, but if you aren't in a large company that already has health care insurance or should have it, you still have your individual mandate. In other words, you still have to go out and purchase by January 1st of next year some sort of health insurance coverage through these insurance exchanges. Of course, if you're in one of the states where they refuse to implement the insurance exchanges, well, you know, that's a big question. Do you still have to go out and purchase insurance yourself, even though there is no exchange with low-cost, quote, predicted lower-cost insurance premiums? You have to still go out and buy the higher insurance premiums? That's up in the air in those states. And what if you're in one of those states where the state Republican governor refuses to implement the Medicare provisions of the act, and you are on Medicare, Medicaid, then you're really in a pickle. Okay, so in July, that employer mandate suspension occurred. Prior to that, in June, small businesses were offered, were let off the hook with a delay as well. Now, they had to choose a single or joint plans, and they were put on a delayed status. And now, just recently, this week, early last week, we have another delay. And that was the cap on out-of-pocket expenses. Under the Act, individuals did not have to pay out-of-pocket for any insurance that they signed up for on an exchange, more than $12,700 a year per family. Well, that's a pretty big out-of-pocket ceiling, isn't it? Okay. $6,350 if you were single. In other words, didn't matter what kind of plan you bought on an exchange, if you were single and you got sick, you wouldn't be required to pay more than $6,350. Okay, and that include prescription drugs, $6,350. Right. By the way, there are some prescription drugs, cancer drugs, and so forth, that cost people $100,000 a year. Did you know that? Don't get cancer, folks. You know? Well, under this provision, you wouldn't pay more than $6,350. Okay, but we just heard last week Obama delayed that one as well. To guess when? 2015. Okay? Get past those midterm elections. If anything looks like a problem, you know, roll it forward so you can say, well, you know, it's not implemented yet, so how can you say it's a problem? We'll solve it when it is implemented. Just to get past the midterm elections here. All right. That's the motive. Right? And Obama and Democrats obviously are counting on business campaign support for the 2014 midterm elections, and they don't want to aggravate business because they may not get the money. All right. The consequences of this, of the whole Obamacare provision and act, is that businesses will continue to cherry pick and put pressure on the Democrats and Congress and Obama to have more and more delays. This is going to happen. You know, we've got three or four major delays already announced. You think it's going to stop there? No. More and more important provisions are going to be suspended temporarily. Well, maybe temporarily, maybe longer than temporarily. We'll see, right? Republicans in the House are using these suspensions and delays to up their tax on Obamacare and make it a big 2014 issue. Right. These delays and suspensions can snowball between now and 2014. We undoubtedly will see more of them. And the snowballing may become an avalanche, quite possibly by the 2016 election, in which case we will see promises on both sides for major, major changes and maybe even dismantling of Obamacare by the next 2016 elections. Right. Now, once again, I said the only solution to this is Medicare for all, perhaps with some sort of option for public, the public option. Public option plus Medicare will save us more than $1 trillion in payments to the middlemen, the insurance companies, that can be then used to expand Medicare for all and fund the public option. Okay, but that's not on the agenda. All right, so that's that topic, Obamacare. And we'll have further updates as we hear more delays and more suspensions. But keep in mind, this is all tied in 2014 elections, and this thing can unravel and get out of hand. I want to now go back and talk about the AFL-CIO convention show we had last week, our three guests. Right? At that time, and all of us agreed, labor, union labor, is in deep, deep trouble. Last year, over 500,000 union jobs disappeared, while more than 1 million jobs were created. Now, most of those million jobs created, million and a half, were part-time temp jobs, low-pay jobs. In just the last 7 months, we've created 900,000 jobs in this country. Two-thirds of those jobs are part-time temp jobs. We'll pay jobs. We're not really creating jobs. You see, the labor market is churning. It's interesting, according to government, if you create a part-time job, it's considered just as much a full-time job for the unemployment rate. It's the same thing. And what's happening is employers are shifting from full-time to part-time employment, and the new jobs being hired, new hirees are mostly part-time jobs. If you look at where the new job creation is occurring, it's mostly in leisure, hospitality, restaurants, so on and so forth, retail. Those are all part-time jobs. Virtually all. Right? Labor is down to 6% in the private sector of the labor force. 6%. You know, even in 1929, with a whole decade of union busting going on in the 1920s, labor was still 9% in the private sector. There were no public workers unionized. So we're at a worse position in the private sector than we were ever in the history of this country in terms of labor union membership. Now, what's holding it all up is 30% plus are still, public workers are still unionized. But there's a big attack. Now they're rolling back that. They're going after that one. Right-to-work laws, in other words, prohibiting by law the requirement of joining a union, are spreading everywhere across the country. Not everywhere, but in a lot of new places. Part-time temporary jobs are being created by the hundreds of thousands. As full-time jobs are being lost. You know, I mentioned a while ago, 900,000 jobs created in the first 7 months of this year, 600,000+ part-time temp jobs. Well, we lost 250,000 full-time jobs at the same time. Indirect tax on collective bargaining, particularly in the public sector, are going on. You know, that's instead of directly attacking the unions, eliminate the unions, well, then you just eliminate what the unions do, collective bargaining, and let them wither on the vine by themselves as they aren't able to attain any improvements for their members. Wisconsin is a good example of that, where they outlawed certain aspects of collective bargaining. As a result, the union, non-union wage differentials, unions always made 20 to 25% more if you were in a union for the same occupation. That's been unraveling or declining. As unions have struggled with this maintenance of benefits strategy for two decades now to put their negotiated increases on benefits, on pensions, and on health care. You have to forego wage increases. So the union non-union differential comparison, in other words, shrinks, and wages shrink in general. Right? Decades ago, the unions, 1980, were 50% of all national income went to wages. Well, today it's 43%, and even that's an over-exaggeration for reasons I won't explain. Anyway, we have a decline, disappearance of real pension plans. First, eliminating them and converting them to 401k private plans, and now 401ks are in decline as company contributions in various ways are declining for 401ks. And companies are selling off their defined benefit pensions, by the way, to private investors. Yeah, if you have a defined benefit plan, it may no longer be your company's. It may be in the hands of investors, and guess what they're going to do with that? Okay. Public attack on public workers' pensions in Detroit. Using bankruptcy laws to make the workers pay through their pensions in Detroit for the crisis in Detroit, which is not really anything new. This has been going on in the private sector for some time now. This is not new. Using bankruptcy laws, I mean, that's been going on in the airlines industry, the steel industry, and so forth. That's how they get rid of defined pension plans, phony company bankruptcies. And because they declare they're bankrupt, they get out of the pension plan. And they distribute what's left of the pensions or convert them to 401ks or turn them over to the government, PBGC, insurance company for pensions in the private sector. Well, they're just doing the same thing in Detroit now, and you can see more of that. And then, of course, we talked about the 40% excise tax on union negotiated plans. Well, okay, maintenance of benefit strategy. Not only unions declining, but this collective bargaining is declining. So what do the unions do about this? Well, I propose, you know, a lot of discussion going on now at the AFL-CIO convention and elsewhere. I've talked about a few of these things at the beginning of the show today, but I talked about this thing 8 years ago in my book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush, published in 2006, written in 2005. This book is all about the policies that have been responsible for more than $1 trillion every year of income shifted from wage earners to earners of capital incomes and corporations. $1 trillion, not over a quarter century, but every year. Because of the policies since Ronald Reagan, late 70s, early 80s, that have been implemented across the board, tax policies, free trade policies, you know, wage policies, deunionization policies, etc. And I tracked them all in this 500-page book and show how each one of them has contributed so much per year, $40 billion, $70 billion, $80 billion, whatever, and you add them all up every year, over $1 trillion, and that was 8 years ago, $1 trillion a year. Okay. And part of this was, in this book, revealing how the destruction of American unions, part of this whole attack, the corporate offensive. Okay. An offensive legally, politically, at the political level, globally, but also an offensive, at the production level, companies themselves. Add it all up, $1 trillion a year. At the end of this book, the very last pages, I talk about what union labor has to do to stop the offensive. And as part of that discussion, I said that unions must reinvent themselves. And part of that reinvention must be a major organizational restructuring. A major restructuring, not only at the national top level, but at the local level as well. Okay? I'm going to be writing about this in the recent, in coming weeks, and submitting a piece to Talking Union, where I write on a blog on union members, union questions, and you can read my views. But if you want to go back and see what I was talking about, I even put on an org chart, a new organizational chart, in this book, in the concluding pages of this book. I'll reproduce that chart here in the article, which I'll try to put up here on Progressive Radio Network as well, once written by this coming weekend. Okay, reinvent. You know, union structure right now is really over a century old. This is the old American Federation of Labor structure. We had an attempt to create industrial unions in the 30s and 40s, but that's dead now. The industrial unions have been decimated, destroyed by free trade and offshoring and tax policies and technology investment policies. You know, the auto workers is a shadow of what it once was. The same with the steel workers and so forth. Those jobs have been moved overseas, right, or replaced with technology, and those unions are just a mere reflection of what they once were. Right? But if you go back in labor history, 1860s and 70s, the dominant organization was the Knights of Labor Union organization, built upon a certain kind of structure. The 1870s, the Depression destroyed that, eliminated them. Okay, a new structure, the AFL-CIO, craft union structure, smokestack unions. In other words, I'm a union here in this, you know, firefighters, I'm a union here, you know, and I'm building service workers, and I'm another union here, you know, and I'm restaurant workers. That smokestack union organization, that's the AFL-CIO. And it was almost destroyed in the 1920s. And we had a new organizational structure, the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, that revitalized labor. But that ran its course too. And in the 70s and 80s, we began destroying that. And as I said, that's pretty much defunct in name only. And now we have a new crisis here that is undermining even what remains of the AFL Craft Union, Smokestack Union structure. A new crisis. So what is labor going to do? Any reinvention, any revitalization has to have an organizational element to it, and that organizational element cannot be just at the top, restructuring the AFL-CIO executive board, which is what this discussion is in the upcoming convention. It must have a local level restructuring. Now, the impetus coming for this discussion in the AFL-CIO is not only just the crisis that's in the advanced stage for the union labor in this country, but what appears to be a kind of positive emergence of what's called workers' centers, over 200 of them across the country, which seem to be much more vital. They're at a local level. They're doing things. They're not part of the official AFL-CIO structure, but they seem to be able to do things and are doing things that the AFL-CIO has taken notice of. In fact, even corporations have taken the notice of it. Some businesses are now, big businesses are asking the National Labor Relations Board to look into whether these should be considered unions too, these worker centers. Because if you label them unions, then you can bring the full weight of passed laws to restrict the unions. You know, since 1947, we've had a real legal web, a web that has tied labor, union labor's hands, increasingly, and they can't do much, or they get sued, or they get thrown in jail, or whatever. You know, this legal web has pretty much neutralized labor at the point of production, so that labor only has left a political strategy. So the AFL-CIO is increasingly relied upon trying to tie itself to the Democratic Party apron strings here and trying to do politically, through political lobbying, what it can't do anymore at the industrial level, strikes, boycotts, so on and so forth, because of the legal web. And these worker centers seem to be outside the legal web. A couple interesting articles have appeared since this AFL-CIO announcement of discussion. Wade Rathke, a founder of ACORN, you know, Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN. This is what the Republicans went after and pulled the financial plug on. One of the founders had a recent piece in the TalkingUnion.org blog, right, where he didn't put too much promise in the AFL-CIO discussion. You know, for him, this was a lobbying strategy, only top level, political only. And that's the problem. Labor has no power, or very little power, it seems, and decreasing power at the point of production. And therefore, it only has political activity. Therefore, it can only tie itself close to the apron strings of the Democratic Party. And as the crisis deepens and labor's situation gets worse and worse, the top heads tie themselves even more closely to the Democrats, and the Democrats figure, oh, these guys got nowhere else to go, so they give fewer crumbs. It's a vicious downward cycle. Anyway, Rathke thinks this is politics, as usual. Another interesting piece came out from Bill Fletcher, an ex-AFL-CIO staffer, and now associated with Industrial Policy Studies, past president for Trans-Africa Forum, a real thinker. Bill's a real thinker here, strategist. And he came out with a piece on portside.org. Take a look at it. And mentioned that the AFL-CIO in recent months has set up these listening committees. In other words, they're finally just trying to get some ideas from the grassroots here. Right? But Bill Fletcher says, quote, if AFL-CIO is only talking about lobbying, then, quote, they are toast, unquote. A majority of people who are not in unions have been told and they want to join the unions, but they don't see the unions as interested in them, the unorganized, only interested in protecting the shrinking pies of their existing members, right? There's no perception that AFL-CIO is going to fight for non-union workers, especially the unemployed. And Bill concludes saying that action, not rhetoric, is what's needed here. Well, I believe that as well. Again, going back to my book, The War at Home, concluding pages, talked about the dimensions of the crisis and the causes of the crisis of union labor and the decline up to 2005 of collective bargaining in the unions, and predicting this decline would get worse. What I predicted has, of course, occurred. I talked about in these concluding pages about the AFL-CIO reforms in 1995 and the split with the change to wing unions, Teamsters, and SEIU, and so forth, 2005. Neither of those have really achieved much, and labor shares continuing to decline. Okay, so I'm running out of time, but I did want to talk about my provisions for an organization restructuring of the AFL-CIO. I guess I'm going to have to put that off to next week. We will take that up. I will describe what I proposed back in 2005 in terms of AFL-CIO union labor restructuring across the board. And just to give you a brief... I think we're running out of time. So let's go back to that and look for my article. And we will talk about that next week. My proposal for restructuring the AFL-CIO in the 21st century. And it's pretty comprehensive, as we will see, but it's got to be done. Labor community action has to occur structurally at the local level, not just at the top. That's the theme here. Okay, so next week we'll talk about that subject. We'll talk about the Democracy Convention report in North Carolina, Moral Monday's fight. See you next week, Alternative Visions.